you've now met the stated requirement of locking it down for internal and external admin access to network infrastructure.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bytes, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Valkovsky, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello and good morning, everyone. This is Joe Manji and Troy McDonald for Education Matters on Gateway Radio WGTD 91.1 HD. Thank you for the gift of your presence this morning and for listening to us, all of the fine folks from Kenosha, Racine, Salem, Westosha, Delavan, and even the North Chicago suburbs. Education Matters is a Gateway Technical College program that features people who are making a positive difference in our respective communities, people who are practicing peace and kindness, people we're proud of for all that they do to make things better for all of us. Today, we have the honor. We're visiting with Troy McDonald, digital director here at Gateway Radio, a radio program host, and a graduate student at the Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Troy is excelling. He's absolutely a dignitary. So, Troy, thank you for sharing your remarkable journey with us this morning. From homeless to Harvard in 4 years. It's a miracle. I don't know how you did it. You have true grit. So, tell us, how are you doing? Troy, how are you doing this morning?
Well, Joe, I mean, what an introduction. I mean, my gosh. I didn't know what my future had for me. I didn't know what was in store for me. And so to now, all these years later, know that I'm going to be at Harvard Yard, in Harvard Yard, getting my master's degree.
And I remember you on stage at the Mondragano Center, Martin Luther King Day, and you're the keynote speaker. And then afterwards, you told me that you were living out of a car. And I remember the sport coat you had on, wasn't it a white sport? You looked spiffy on stage. How did you pull that day off?
That day was one of the most difficult days, but I've never watched it back. So that day was very interesting. My mother had talked with a coworker who allowed us to stay overnight in her basement. She had an open basement where she was living, a coworker. And so I was able to go to my car, pull out my box of stuff, and I found that sport coat. And I thought, you know, this would be a kind of spiffy thing. But the week beforehand it was difficult too, because I wrote that speech, and here I am rehearsing this speech in my car in a McDonald's parking lot, you know, wherever I could. And then the few days before thing, because of course you're speaking in front of 500 people, but I wasn't really nervous about that. It was the delivery. I wanted to make sure that my message got across. And I wanted it to be somewhat hopeful, but realistic. And it was a very, very, it was like this weird dichotomy, because at one point you realize you're the keynote speaker. You are speaking in front of 500 people.
Right.
Then not feeling almost worthy enough to step into that moment. I'm homeless. My family's homeless.
Right.
What authority do I have to speak to this group of people and inspire them to do anything? So all of these, all of those thoughts were going through my head, right? And still having to find that sport coat at the end of the day and put on my best self and go up there. It was very hard. And like I said, I have never watched it back because it just takes me back to that time. And I don't necessarily want to go back there, I guess.
Words that you stated, I mean, you blew everybody away, including myself. And that event is probably the one time of the year when the crowd is very diverse. Black people, brown people, white people, Asian people. It's probably the only...
It was like, what, 2014, 2015? I believe. Gosh, in my early 20s.
Yeah.
22, 23, something around there.
Well, you blew everybody away when you said that you had never experienced racism up to that point. But then you said poverty is racism.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about poverty being racism?
Right. I think part of the reason I haven't looked back at it is because I was very idealistic.
Yes.
And in my early 20s, I guess I wasn't connecting the dots because I actually had been through some racially tinged experiences.
Sure.
It wasn't at the same level of what my mother had gone through, who was a baby boomer from the civil rights era in Chicago, which was much more segregated and still is than people think. But they were still incidents, right? Microaggressions, I think, is the term scholars use now. And so in hindsight, I wish I would have rephrased that and say that the racism of today just looks differently. It's silent. Scholar Carol Anderson calls it a kindling.
Okay.
Right. That it's the match might not be a burning inferno, but that kind of kindling fire is always there. It's always the undercurrent of the country. And so in that context, poverty is a group of systemic choices made for at least the last 50 years, whether it's who has access to, right, or an Uber ride that costs, you know, significant amount of money.
We talked about food deserts years ago in cities like Kenosha, and nothing's changed. It's still a food desert, you know, other than, you know, corner speedway gas stations or quick trips.
Mm-hmm.
What is there?
Right.
You know?
Right. And so when you talk about, and food policy is just one aspect, but housing policy,
right,
who has access to jobs and employment, who can get into the interview rooms with decision makers.
Sure.
Right. There have been numerous studies that show that people with black sounding names and people with traditionally white sounding names with the same resume, the white resume applicant gets the interview almost three times as often. So it is a group of choices that has been made over, you know, at least in the modern context since the 1950s and 60s. And so looking back at that speech, there were a lot of those contradictions because I still, and I, of course, you have to believe I wouldn't be here. My ancestors went through a lot worse than I have, right? They toiled in the fields and my mother went through so much. And so I have to believe that there's something. But the more realistic point is that if we're going to address those issues, it's not to say that they don't exist. It's to say that they are systemic, that they are recurring, and to get to the root of the policies, the systemic policies that enable these, enable poverty, enable food deserts and the like.
So, Troy, how did you get from Kenosha to Harvard? Can you talk a little bit about how did you do that?
Well, I've always been a very good writer, and it's something that I pride myself on. And so I had no reason to believe, you know. And I will say that I've always been very academically smart.
Yes, you have.
And so
And you are.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And so I just said, you know, I'm going to throw my name on the hat. I'm going to write something about my story.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out probably the semester before, the fall semester before. And you know, a lot of people get that confused. The undergraduate admissions process is very different than the graduate school admissions process.
Okay.
And so you still have to be at the top of your game, I think.
Right.
You know, very few people make it.
Now, you had a degree from UW-Stout.
Yes, I had a degree in communications from UW-Stout, where that really did help me, where I basically got all, you know, straight A's.
Yeah.
So that really did help me. I think I got maybe one or two B's. And so that was a really strong academic record, but it was also my writing ability and my storytelling ability.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I found out in the fall of 2018... that I was going, and then I made it. I almost didn't believe it, and so I didn't publicize it until December of 2018.
I remember you kept it as a secret from us and peace circles, and then you sprung it on us, and we're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Holy cow, we know somebody that's at Harvard, you know. That is just amazing. So how did you become a good writer? Are there any tips for young people? How do you become a good writer?
I'm a firm believer that a good story, a good, well-written story, can almost unlock almost any door for you. And how you do that is that you don't think about what people are going to think. You think about the truth of it, right?
Sure.
You try to find a kernel of truth that everyone can relate to. And that's harder and harder to do these days.
Yes.
But everyone has very similar experiences. Whether for me, you know, hopefully they've never been through homelessness like I've been. But they understand what it's like to be alone, afraid, scared through some sort of situation they've been in. I think most people have had. I'm safe to say most people have felt that. And so the best writing, I think, makes people feel something. It reaches through the phone, the screen, the paper, and grabs you and doesn't let go. Another thing which people might find funny, I'm a huge wrestling fan.
You are?
Professional wrestling.
Oh, my goodness.
And people, oh, well, that's, you know, it's all scripted entertainment. And that is true. But there are millions of people who watch every single week and pay their hard-earned money to see something that is scripted.
Yeah.
So there must be, so I say that to say that the way that they're able to tell stories and evoke emotion out of people, some of those same skill sets have made me a very good writer because I understand how to pull emotional, you know, feelings out of people in a way that I think wrestling does best.
Wow.
People might not expect that, but.
I'm learning something. I wouldn't have put two and two together. So you're saying that wrestling is really telling a story.
100%.
With emotion and feelings. And
predetermined.
Wow.
It's about the emotion that the athletes, the wrestlers are creating to make you hate someone or to make you love someone. And those same tenets have made me a good writer. Of course, I'm not you're threatening anyone. Yeah, I'm going to take you down on Sunday night. But, you know, it's about how do you use your words and lay out your story for the maximum emotional impact.
That's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought of that. Okay, so you're at Harvard and you're going to graduate with a master's degree. What's been your most rewarding experience at Harvard so far?
I've had so many. One of my first trips out there was to Cambridge, to campus, was with Professor John Stauffer, who is a very well-renowned scholar. His expertise is in the Civil War, and specifically Frederick Douglass, and the myriad of photographs that were taken. He was one of the most, Frederick Douglass, one of the most photographed men in America. And so I was in his class, and we went to lunch. I was sitting right across from him like I am you today. Someone who I've watched in documentaries forever since I was a child. And to be in the same room, same lunch table, dining table as him was just remarkable. So that was a rewarding experience. I don't think I can pick just one. Another experience I had was with Professor Todd Washburn. And I was kind of done writing papers, final papers. I was kind of bored with it, to be quite honest with you. So I went to him and I said, you know what?
Wow.
I want to write a manuscript of a Simpsons. What's the most iconic American modern family? One of them for my generation is the Simpsons.
Sure. It's been on for like 30 years.
30 years, right? Yeah. And so I thought I could tell a really interesting story about polarization, political divisiveness through the Simpsons. And so my professor said, I'd never seen anything like this. Go for it. And I turned it in, and I did very well on that assignment. So that was really rewarding, stepping out of the box. The people that you meet, I've had amazing experiences with Chasten Buttigieg, who is the husband of Pete Buttigieg,
okay.
who was a really fascinating speaker to listen to. I've met so many people from all different walks of government and life. I've met former Harvard president Drew Faust. So many rewarding experiences that have made me a better human being mm-hmm. and a smarter human being. I guess the saying is that when you go there, you come out and you're kind of this polished, machine. And that's partially true.
So many United States presidents have graduated from Harvard and, including Barack Obama, the most recent Harvard graduate.
And now we have soon-to-be-confirmed Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, Harvard.
Right. So Harvard, I've always thought, is about leadership. What are they teaching? How are they teaching people to be better?
Well, everyone agrees with one thing, and it's kind of this center of groupthink that everyone... And one of the most surprising things was that there were so many different voices with different opinions mm-hmm. there. I was pleasantly surprised. And so one of the core tenets that we've been discussing and that I've discussed during my tenure was that you have to be a very good listener. Mm-hmm. You have to always be willing to say the hard truths, right? Not to avoid the difficult truths. And be willing to take risks. Believe in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, fellow students, is that you have to back up everything you're saying with data.
Okay.
This is not just go out on a whim and, pontificate on a hilltop,
right.
In Massachusetts, right? This is a very scientific-based, research-based institution. Research your work. And it is, I remember the first assignment I turned in, I turned in a screed. And he said, this is not going to work, my professor at the time, which was John Stauffer. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is not going to work. You're going to have to go back and all of these points that you're making, they might be able to be made, but you're going to have to go and find, the work to do that. And so I think that is a very important tenet. And also, too, but to do it, I think the revised that I would add to that is to do it slowly.
Okay.
Everything moves so fast today.
Yes.
There's one story and then there's there's always the next thing. So to be willing to take risks, calculated risks, but to make sure that you're thinking about mm-hmm. those risks from the entirety of the scope, the entire scope of them. So
listening is such an important quality, and it's difficult in this day and age because you get I'm right, you're wrong end of story, and it's tough to get your explanation out, your words out, because oftentimes people don't want to hear it. And so I could get three words out of my mouth. You talk too slow, Joe.
I'm told that too.
So in peace learning circles, we use the 3-second rule, that if two students are having an argument, that one of them or both of them has to listen. And so when you're finished saying what you have to say, catch up with their mouth, so to speak, and listen. We use with all of the fouls, bullying, teasing, kidding, shunning, and I put it in the handkerchief and I stuff it into my left hand, the palm of my left hand. And okay, everybody, practice peace. And poof, I hold both hands out and it's gone. And my left hand, kids are looking up my sleeve, they're looking in my pocket. They ask me to turn around. Nobody is looking at my right hand, where the fake finger sleeve is on my index finger with the red handkerchief inside. So, the story, you can't look at just what is the most vocal. So the 3-second rule.
Right.
So, being a better listener, what are they teaching you at Harvard? What are you picking up? How are you becoming a better listener?
It's interesting because there are definitely very heated conversations that I've been in class.
Okay.
In classes, in which I've learned is that I appreciate how someone I disagree with lays out their argument.
Okay.
And I think the best listeners understand the court. There are some amazing people in the, and I don't want to name them or list them because we love everybody.
Sure.
But there are people in the House of Representatives or in the Senate, Wisconsin State Assembly, who I might disagree with, you might disagree with at home, but I can listen to them and see how they lay out their argument and appreciate what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so even at the bare minimum, I listen to them, I see what they're saying, what they're trying to say, and I try not to react to that. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's, and I have made mistakes that I deeply regret, but at the same time, I've you know, you grow from those things. And what I've learned through my teaching at Harvard is that you have to appreciate the arguments of people who you don't like. And I've done that. So that's the best way. That's what I think the best listeners do, is they figure out how to enrich their own arguments on mm-hmm. social media. I've given talks on that. And so I think what I'm saying is a very lofty ideal for a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. It's not easy to do that, to listen to people, especially in this climate in which things are so polarized. We are the most polarized we've been, I mean, what, since the Civil War?
In my lifetime,
yeah.
It's the most divisive that I've ever seen it. So how do you get, I mean, we've all read books about getting to yes and the art of the compromise. But nobody wants to compromise. Nobody wants to get to yes. It's my way or the highway, you know. I will never vote for you. I will never vote for what you stand for. How do we, is there hope for us as a democratic society of working towards compromise?
So I was, one of my favorite classes, I mentioned this professor earlier. His name was Todd Washburn, an amazing, amazing professor. And he said that democracy, what I think he was trying to say was that when you have a group of people who are so deeply entrenched, whose identities are tied, whose livelihoods are tied, or perceived, what they perceive to be tied to the outcomes of political races, people make even more irrational decisions.
Yes.
And in the 1950s or 60s, when some of the first studies were conducted on political beliefs, at least in modern context,
sure.
when those studies were beginning to form, most people had many cross, what we call in the space, cross-cutting cleavages, meaning that they had many relationships with people who they didn't agree with. They went to church, and they
right.
went to all right. of these different, had different social interactions. In the 2004 presidential election, one of the greatest predictors of a George W. works best when the temperature is lowered. And I don't know how you lower the temperature when there are very, in some states now, where it is very real, voting rights are being
yes.
taken away. You know, there are other sorts of rights across the country on both sides of the aisle. But people feel that their lives, their well-being, their children's lives are tied to this in a way that was not present in the 1950s or 60s, by and large. Now, with that being said, when these surveys were taken in the 1950s and 60s, they weren't thinking about the Native Americans or the African Americans, right? They were not frequently brought into these discussions. And so there are a lot of people who might hear what I'm saying and say, well, it wasn't that we didn't care. We didn't have a platform to share our voice as openly as we do now. So I take that argument as well. But I think the point of my professor, and I think it's a correct one, is that democracy works best. And I think the only future we have with it in the American context is if the temperature is lowered.
Right.
And I've made mistakes. And I also think, too, that we have to understand that we should not live in a cancel. Their whole lives have been online, right? They're going to say things. It's going to be.
Yes. So. Yes, you're right about that. What's the word? Make it obsolete. Just delete. If somebody says something bad about you online. Okay. I thought that was cool. But by the way, everybody, this is Troy McDonald and Joe Manji. WGTD Radio, Education Matters, and we're having a great discussion about Troy's journey. He's about to graduate from the John F. Kennedy School of Government with a master's degree. Troy, what's your master's degree in?
It's in centered on the public policy standpoint in government.
So, with the war in Ukraine, with the war in Afghanistan, with the planet, ecology, global warming, all of these global issues, what have you learned or what are you learning about global affairs and the art of diplomacy? Does it exist anymore? It seems like it does. I mean, people are trying. What are your thoughts?
We live in very daunting times. I mean, there's no way around that. I mean, we are in very daunting times. And I think what I've learned about diplomacy is that I think some of the old tricks of the trade, the understanding that we wanted, I mean, at the, you know, maybe, and Joe, you can speak more to this as you've had, you know, a lot of this work in your background, but my understanding is that most people wanted a liberal world order, right? They wanted a world order, and I don't mean liberal as in the American democratic context. I mean liberal as in we recognize sovereign borders. We recognize, at least for the last 40, you know, since the World War II, and we were just under that almost level of comfortability that's kind of what we wanted as global actors. I think we have to throw that playbook out of the window.
Yes.
China has proved that autocracy, though damaging to, I mean, you see what's happening with the Uyghurs, population that are currently imprisoned, but that autocracy has been a very interesting form of government, and we are in a battle with that form of democracy is in a battle with autocracy.
Sure.
And you have a lot of leaders in this country and outside of this country determining what that's going to take shape. And I think it really is going to come down to Ukraine. I don't wish violence on anyone. I don't wish violence on any. Do not just in Ukraine, but around the world to fight for the tenets of democracy.
Right.
And my fear is that, you know, with the way that we have conducted diplomacy for the last 50 years, 60 years, what's the win for staying in a democracy, right? Part of the reason why the civil rights movement was so effective was not just because of the hard work of Martin Luther King Jr., not to negate the work of the many civil rights, he's just one of them, us as a democracy, right? What is advantageous about democracy for other countries, right? Not that we are going to spread democracy. I think we're hopefully done doing that. But right, what's the incentive for leaders to maintain democracy in its current state? I don't know what that sales pitch is, right? And as a citizen of democracy, I love the freedom. I love being able to say and to speak freely. But I think that it comes with its costs, and we are living through those real costs today. So I believe that we have to figure this, as you are on the board of
the Peace Corps. What are you finding as you're dealing with countries that are, you know, in the midst of this battle between autocracy and democracy?
Well, I have been appointed to the National Peace Corps Board of Directors for the country of Iran. And I was a Peace Corps volunteer, a division in the United States State Department in Iran for 2 years, from 1966 to 1968, including 1 month in Afghanistan. And it's a shame because we from that era feel like we've been erased because Peace Corps was in Iran from 1961 to 76. In Afghanistan, the same amount of time, there was peace. Peace Corps, prior to the epidemic, has been in 60 different countries around the world, including the Ukraine, including Poland, including South Korea. So you learn the language. At the time, I was fluent in Farsi. Sabaka Mullah Belkhair, Alhamdulillah, Ahrahmani Rahim. I'm just showing off, but I can go on and on. But you respect other cultures in part by learning languages. I'm a firm believer of all students in the U.S. should learn a second language. You choose German, French, Italian, Mandarin, Chinese, something to understand and appreciate cultures from around the planet. I would have thought that with COVID, which was affecting every nation on earth, that somehow, some way, it would have brought us all together to collectively go after this virus, which may continue to uproot again and again and again. We don't know that. But it would have been a way to bring us all together, get everybody on the planet vaccinated. But there are people who, I've been to all of those countries, even Kashmir up in the Himalayan mountain range. Martin Luther King made 3 visits to Milwaukee during his lifetime. The second one was January 27th, 1964. It was 8 degrees above zero. I marched with him in the parade down Wisconsin Avenue from King Brager Chevrolet past Marquette High all the way down to the old Milwaukee Auditorium where he spoke before 7,000 people. And Martin Luther King was there as a healer because 2 months prior to that, John F. Kennedy had been assassinated. So what I remember about that day, other than freezing, I was scared because we all thought that J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI was going to arrest us all and we'd get kicked out of Marquette because he was dogging Dr. King and John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. But the crowds, I wish you could have been there, Troy, the crowds lining the sidewalks and the streets cheering on Dr. King. There were several hundred thousand people, not a single boo. You just had goosebumps to this day. People were cheering. The Milwaukee Police Department cleared out the Milwaukee Auditorium looking for bombs or devices twice. They put their lives on the line for Dr. King. And he spoke about bringing us all together. I didn't have a ticket to get in. I mean, 7,000 people packed the auditorium, but there were another 20,000 of us standing outside that auditorium, wow, listening on loudspeakers to his message, freezing our buns off. But hey, it was Dr. King. And that led me to joining the Peace Corps after I graduated from Marquette. And that day, Marquette University stood up to J. Edgar Hoover because they awarded Dr. King with an honorary doctorate for community service and what he was doing to bring the country together. The FBI threatened Marquette with sanctions if they went through with it. Marquette stood up to equity and the rights of working people, bringing people together.
Are you surprised, you know, from someone in the millennial generation, are you surprised that we're still here because of all of the energy? I mean, you just spoke of 20,000 people in the streets, that kind of visceral energy. Mm-hmm. And we're facing, obviously, different issues today. We can be in the same room here.
Right.
Right, that's progress. But what surprises you most about us being here in the same place as a nation or a similar place?
Look at the Milwaukee Bucks, the little town fighting the big-time NBA when everything is stacked against them. We all know they weren't supposed to win the championship. It was supposed to be either Brooklyn or LeBron in L.A., the big markets. And here's Giannis Antetokounmpo from Greece. And there are 60,000 people in Milwaukee cheering the Bucks on, all in the same place, night after night, and in inclement weather. And yet and still, there's all this violence in Milwaukee. But for that point in time, it stopped. So is there something that will bring us together? What is it? Is it us fighting the pandemic? There needs to be a cause that affects all of us. As you said, you know, political races are tied to people's jobs and well-being. But is there something above that? I mean, we've done it before. Can we do it again? The greatest generation evolved out of World War II. I still have hope for us. I still have hope for a future where we can all come together for our children and our grandchildren. How about you, Troy? Next steps?
Next steps. Well, I'm hoping to continue to do great work. I want to eventually go on for my doctorate degree. Mm-hmm. And be able to help shape policy and shape and help make the world a better place. I mean, that sounds so generic and so cheesy, but I do believe that work is needed. It's not mm-hmm. done. It's never over. That work always continues. And so what my mother did for me, instilling in me that I could do anything that I believed in, mm-hmm. despite all of the odds, she had no reason to tell me that. I want to be able to do that for someone else or for a different group of people.
Manager. Hey, everybody, I think time's up. We could go on for hours. We'll have part two coming up. How's that?